Boy v. Attorney General, appellate number
18-3595. Good morning, and may it please the court, Tylin Traer for the government. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, if I may.
Granted, thank you.
Plaintiff is prohibited from possessing a firearm under Section 922G1 as a result of his conviction under Pennsylvania law for driving under the influence at the highest rate of alcohol.
But isn't the issue in this case whether it qualifies as the kind of serious offense that our en banc court in Binderup described?
That's correct. And under the factors that this court considered in Binderup, driving at the highest rate of alcohol does qualify as a serious offense. Binderup left no doubt that some misdemeanor crimes are serious offenses. And in that section of the opinion, Binderup cited to Tennessee v. Gardner, where the Supreme Court recognized drunk driving in particular as the type of misdemeanor that involves a more significant physical threat than even some felony offenses.
It's typically considered a traffic offense, although it may result in, of course, serious consequences. But drunk driving, isn't it generally considered a traffic offense?
Well, yes, but as the district court noted here, there's no doubt as to the perilous and tragic outcomes of drunk driving. And as the worst type of drunk driving offense here, the Pennsylvania legislature sought to impose more heightened penalties precisely because it found that the lion's share of alcohol-related driving fatalities are caused by individuals who engage in drunk driving with excessively high blood alcohol levels.
The offense itself is not the focus, but rather the consequences of those who engage in drunk driving. Is that what we're to look at?
Well, no, we're looking at the crime of conviction here, driving under the influence of the highest rate of alcohol, which the Pennsylvania legislature...
So the focus is just the statute itself.
Well, the focus is to the offense that plaintiff committed, but for instance, in the Binderup opinion, the court looked to whether or not the offense committed was a violent one. And while there's no formal element of violence here, the crime is no less violent for that fact. And as the district court noted, again, the thousands of fatalities that result from this type of offense, that's exactly why the legislature...
Does this mean that we look at the potential for violence?
No, I think it informs why the Pennsylvania legislature considered this a serious offense. And so Binderup said that we presume the judgment of the state legislature to be correct, absent a strong reason to displace that judgment. And that burden, of course, is on the challenger. And here, there's no dispute by the district court who acknowledged that, for example, a second DUI offense, regardless of blood alcohol level, certainly demonstrates maladjustment and reckless disregard for the safety and well-being of others.
So you're talking about it presents a danger and a lack of virtuousness if we're going back to
correct,
the
to the true justification, yes, underlying why those who commit serious offenses forfeit their Second Amendment rights. I think it's not just a dangerous offense, it's a reckless offense. The offense demonstrates an inherent reckless disregard for the safety of others.
So are you asking us to add a factor basically to the Binderup non-exhaustive list where it talked about, like, is it a felony? What's the exposure? Is there an element of violence? Are you at and cross-jurisdictional consensus? So are you asking us to consider another factor?
No, we're not saying it's necessary to consider another factor. I think in looking at whether or not the crime is a violent one, all these considerations that the Pennsylvania legislature looked to are
apparent. But didn't the Supreme Court already hold that DUIs are not violent? And when it was either doing the ACCA or the sentencing guidelines, one of their pronouncements on this subject. So they already took it out from being violent. So why? But you keep using language that talks about potential for danger to others. So...
Well, several points there, Your Honor. One, the Supreme Court looked to whether or not drunk driving qualified as a violent felony, met certain statutory criteria that the court later held to be unconstitutionally vague. But my only point is to your Honor's earlier question that whether or not the offense is a violent one speaks to the seriousness of the offense, and we have that nexus here, and the district court recognized all of that in the way that it recognize that the Pennsylvania legislature went out of its way to punish more severely this offense far beyond the traditional sentence ascribed to a felony.
Maybe that's what the focus should be. How does the state of Pennsylvania treat this type of offense? And apparently it does treat it seriously because Mr. Holloway was sentenced to a term in jail because of drunk driving. So
that's exactly right, Your Honor.
And the legislature do treat this as a very serious offense, apparently.
We have a very robust legislative history here where the Pennsylvania General Assembly stated that it meant to make clear the driving while under the influence of alcohol is, quote, a very serious matter in Pennsylvania.
For instance, you know, there are major differences, though, between the impediments for a felony and a misdemeanor. The right to vote specifically is one of them. A misdemeanant in Pennsylvania is allowed to vote. A felon is not allowed to vote. So that and other right to serve on a jury, some of these characteristics are not those that attach to misdemeanors.
Gooder no doubt recognized that there are some distinctions between felony and misdemeanor crimes, although Gooder also recognized that the Supreme Court itself has stated that those differences sometimes are minor.
Yeah, but doesn't this go into the question that Judge Fuentes asked, how Pennsylvania characterized it?
Yes, but I think looking here to what the General Assembly did in 2003, it overhauled entirely its drunk driving laws to specifically grade drunk driving as it's committed with higher blood alcohol levels to punish more severely those offenses as an individual gets behind the wheel having consumed more alcoholic drinks. And so this is the worst offense in its class, a misdemeanor punishable by 5 years of imprisonment. I don't think there's any doubt as to how serious the Pennsylvania legislature considered this offense. But to go back to another point that Judge Fuentes has made, also under Binderup, when we're looking
Stop you right there. Is that fair to somebody like Mr. Holloway, who, by the fate of where he was driving at that time, got convicted under Pennsylvania law, whereas if he was in most other states, he would not have been charged with an offense that was that serious?
Does
a Pennsylvanian have less Second Amendment rights as a result than someone who resides in West Virginia?
No, that's not what we're saying, Your Honor. Congress left a role for the states and deferred to considered judgments of state legislatures, but the federal prohibition is not constitutionally infirm on that basis. The Supreme Court has recognized in a different context that because of the state's role here in this scheme, that it is inevitable to some extent that some sentences are going to be different. But under Binderup, we look to the seriousness of the offense. We look to whether or not the particular crime of conviction here has been considered serious by the state legislature, and that is what we have here. We also have numerous.
Should the focus be on the potential penalty? Because how do you come to the conclusion this is really serious? That is what's commonly known as drunk driving.
I think the clearest indication is the maximum sentence imposed by the legislature, which is a 5-year.
That's really my question. Do you look at the penalty that can be imposed, whether the maximum sentence, whether it includes a term in jail or not? And that goes back to Judge Fisher's question. Some states don't do that. Why should we consider it a serious offense here when other states, even perhaps in our circuit, do not?
Well, so several points there, Your Honor. I do think the clearest indication is the maximum sentence described by the legislature. But of course, the court in Binderup also looked to the cross-jurisdictional consensus surrounding the crime. And here, no matter where a plaintiff committed his drunk driving offense, no matter where he drives under the influence of a blood alcohol level of 0.16 or higher, that offense is criminalized. As compared to the offenses at issue in Binderup, a regulatory violation, a consensual sexual relationship with a minor, as the court noted in Binderup, that underlying conduct was not even outlawed in many states. And that's a very different case from what we have here. And not only do we have cross-jurisdictional consensus, but we have here Congress also in 1998 in passing its federal highway funding law sought to encourage states to assign heightened penalties where individuals habitually engage in drunk driving with excessively high blood alcohol levels. We also have several statements from the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has often repeatedly lamented the tragedy of the, quote, carnage caused by drunk drivers. We have consensus between the Supreme Court, Congress, Pennsylvania legislature, and, of course, the district court
Let me ask you this. I thought that I had. Does it matter that there's a significant period of time that passed from the time that he was convicted of drunk driving until the time that he made an application for a weapon? And if I'm not mistaken, I'm trying to recollect, I think it was about 14 years. Should that factor in? He's behaved himself for 14 years.
Not when we're at step one, looking to whether or not plaintiff has distinguished himself from the class of persons historically barred from Second Amendment rights. And Bindera clearly stated that neither the passage of time nor evidence of rehabilitation would be considered at step one. The Second Amendment analysis there proceeds on a categorical basis. So plaintiff is...
Ms. Sather, can I ask you a question, a very basic question for our analysis of this case? Maybe you can help us. Did our Bindera opinion or opinions, did we adopt a test that binds our court and binds us as a panel in determining whether an offense is a serious offense under step one?
Yes, and Judge
Ambrose, what is that test?
Well, as Judge Ambrose's opinion noted, that his opinion, the controlling law in this circuit is looking to the seriousness of the offense. And, of course, this court has recognized...
Well, he talked about a multi-factor test, did he not?
That's right, a non-exhaustive multi-factor test.
Okay, but did a majority of our court agree with that?
Well, under a Marx analysis, Your Honor, it is the narrowest rationale.
Okay, how do you get to the narrow? How do you get to the narrowest rationale?
Well, Your Honor, it is the narrowest rationale that the court outlined in the opinion, but the court subsequently, in, for example, the Beers opinion, has treated the Bindera non-exhaustive, the factors that were outlined in Bindera as the law of this circuit. So I don't think there's any dispute there.
Okay. You're comfortable with that?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Okay. We'll have you back on rebuttal.
May it please the court, good morning. I'm Attorney Joshua Prince, and I represent Mr. Holloway, the appellee in this matter. What is...
Mr. Prince, can I take follow up on Judge Fisher's question, which I had to give some thought to, which has to do with the sentence that may be imposed. And
yes,
in this case, your client was exposed to, if I'm not mistaken, 5 years in prison, even though there was a lapse between the time that he was... sentenced until the time he made an application for a gun. Nonetheless, doesn't that suggest that this is a real serious offense? If he was subjected to, as an offender, as a second offender, to 5 years in prison, although he only got 90 days, I understand.
So, Your Honor, I don't believe it was a serious offense. First and foremost, any misdemeanor of the first
degree... Actually, I'm looking at what the legislature did, and if they concluded that you can be sentenced up to 5 years in prison if you commit this offense, doesn't that suggest that the legislature treats it as a very serious offense?
I don't believe so. Again, first and foremost, they treat it as a misdemeanor, which under the first prong of the Bindera analysis is not dispositive of, but is stated in the Bindera decision to be a very important factor.
But so first we have... interesting, though, that the five-year sentence, although labeled in Pennsylvania as a misdemeanor, under federal law would be a felony, and under... most other states would be labeled a felony. So we're talking about a labeling issue. And back to Judge Fuente's point, regardless of the label, 5 years in prison with a mandatory minimum sentence, doesn't that communicate the Pennsylvania legislature's view that this is a serious crime for which a serious sentence should be considered by the sentencing judge?
And if that were the case, Mr. Bindrup would have failed in his challenge because he, too, was convicted of a misdemeanor of the first degree, statutory sexual assault, or excuse me, corruption of a minor. He was charged also with statutory, but the only offense he was convicted of was corruption of a minor.
But there was no mandatory minimum jail sentence
right.
That he faced, where an offender of this sort faces a mandatory minimum prison sentence.
Of 90 days.
Which the
court found was improper for Mr. Holloway, actually granted him work release, but couldn't alleviate him of the mandatory 90 days. Also, a significant factor that I think the court needs to be aware of is the co-plaintiff in the combined cases of Bindrup, Mr. Suarez, was convicted of a DUI. And in the Bindrup case, this court's majority opinion states that they find that Mr. Suarez's DUI that occurred after the incident that actually triggered his prohibition was non-serious and was not something that would prohibit him from being able to successfully bring the Second Amendment as applied challenge to his carrying of a firearm without a license in Maryland.
But he had a different, his offense was different. He was not at the highest level of alcohol. He didn't face a mandatory minimum. I don't know that you can analogize the criminal conviction of one against the other when there was a different exposure, different statute. And again, I go back to Judge Fuente's question to you is, how do we discount the Pennsylvania legislature's decision and its language about why?
If I may, I would suggest looking to Pennsylvania law. In Pennsylvania law, as we've addressed in our brief, in section 18 PACS, section 6105C3, it specifies that in order for an individual to lose the right only to purchase new firearms, but still keep the firearms they own, they must be convicted of 3 DUIs in a 5-year period. An individual could have 20 separate DUIs, still be able to purchase and possess firearms, provided that 3 DUIs do not come in a 5-year period.
I missed what you started to say. What is the basis for that? What law is that?
That's in 18 PACS section 6105C3. It does have its own section in our brief where we address it. And in fact, Chief Judge Connor also addressed it in his decision.
But that hypothetical person who doesn't hit the blood alcohol level of the serious, the higher one, that person could have 3 and be disqualified. So he's done a lesser offense and loses firearm. Doesn't that undercut your argument?
I don't believe so, because we said we were going to look to see how the state treats DUI. And if we're going to look to how the state treats DUI, not look to the federal prohibition, strictly the state prohibition, state law says you need to get 3 DUIs in a 5-year period to lose your right to purchase new firearms.
Yeah, but in actuality, as Judge Schwartz is alluding to, that catch-all of 3 within a 5-year period could be 3 convictions for .08 or even less. I think it does cut against your argument.
Well, and that's fair enough. But again, the only thing we do have in relation that we know where the General Assembly of Pennsylvania addressed in relation to DUI firearms prohibitions is section 6105C3. There, the General Assembly said, whatever the grading of the DUIs, if you get 3 in 5, you're prohibited. They could have said, if you get 2 of the highest blood alcohol content in 5 years, we're going to prohibit you. They did not do that. And that's why, if we look to state law, I do not believe that there is any support for Pennsylvania, the General Assembly within Pennsylvania, treating it as a serious offense.
What about all the comments by the Supreme Court of the United States? Various justices have made observations. Your colleague made reference to Tennessee v. Garner about the fact that DUIs pose tremendous danger to the public. Why shouldn't we consider that as among the indicia of seriousness?
Because once again, we see case after case. One of the Supreme Court cases was Begay, B-E-G-A-Y versus U.S., where in there they acknowledge, yes, DUI does have some harmful effect to society, and by no means am I condoning it, but at the same time, it's not so serious. It's not treated so serious to strip individuals of constitutional rights. And in fact, this is the only right that we strip.
I'm focusing on the sentence in prison. You say it's not treated seriously. The legislature says if you do this and you're found guilty, you will maybe sentence up to 5 years in prison.
And that was the same for Bindrup. And so if that is the analysis, that is directly contrary to this court's en banc decision in Bindrup, where this court held that a misdemeanor of the first degree was not of such a character that precluded the plaintiff from successfully
challenged. We didn't hold that all misdemeanors of the first degree are not of such a character.
That is correct, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. But the criteria the court specified was, first we look whether it's a misdemeanor or a felony, and that a misdemeanor is a significant factor in determining that a state did not believe it to be serious.
Okay.
Then,
all right, there's no question here. You have a that Mr. Holloway was convicted of a misdemeanor, first degree misdemeanor. Where do we go from there?
Well, I truly.
What's our next step?
Was it violent is the next issue under the first prong of Bindurup.
Okay.
And then, and again, every court to look at it has acknowledged that DUI is nonviolent.
All right.
Then we move on to the cross-state jurisdictional analysis.
And what does that show us?
So we spent a substantial amount of time in our brief. We did provide a 50-state survey to the district court that the district court relied on. This court has before it. And depending on whether you categorize Mr. Holloway's DUI as a first or second DUI, will change the analysis. But even taking the government's position that it is a second DUI offense, only seven states, even looking at the highest categories that could be imposed for different blood alcohol contents, would trigger a prohibition under federal law in this situation. So, for example, if Mr. Holloway had found himself in Arizona, he would not, and had committed the same exact offense, he would not have triggered any prohibition under 922G1.
But your adversary made a point during her presentation that the states are criminalizing the conduct. It's not just a traffic violation. It's been criminalized. Doesn't that demonstrate a cross-jurisdictional message that this is a serious offense, that it's criminal?
All Second Amendment as applied challenges are going to relate to criminal conduct. Generally speaking, if we're not, let me restate that. All Second Amendment as applied challenges under 922G1 are going to relate to criminal conduct.
I understand that, of course. I understand that, because otherwise you would have the condition precedent that would cause you to be disqualified from carrying a firearm. I understand that. My point is, your adversary just made a point, and I hear what you're saying, that the states do differ in terms of the nature of the punishment, and hence whether it would trigger 922G prohibition. I understand you right there. My question to you is, it goes to the criminalization of it, and that there's a cross-jurisdictional agreement that it's a criminal act. Do you agree with that statement?
As our cross-jurisdictional analysis supports, in every state there are crimes for DUI. Every state, it varies, and what the maximum sentence that could be imposed is, what different obligations an offender may have in ignition interlocks and things such as that. But one of the other issues that we addressed in our briefing is the fact that in no state do they, in essence, permanently deprive someone of the privilege of having a driver's license, whereby there is no recourse for them to get it reinstated. There were, I believe, five states where it suggests it's permanent, but yet there were mechanisms in place for someone to still petition. What we do see is that in order for any of the states to strip someone of that privilege, they have to at least have committed three DUIs.
That's
a privilege, not a right.
Is it inappropriate to consider a deterrence effect of the drunk driving statutes? When that penalty is imposed, when someone is dispossessed of the right to have a...
Respectfully, Your Honor, I have yet to meet a criminal defense attorney, a district attorney, or many judges who understand that a second DUI can trigger any prohibition under federal law. My experience has been Pennsylvania attorneys look to state law. They see the 6105C3 prohibition and advise a client, oh, no, you didn't get three DUIs in a five-year period. This isn't a felony that's specified in 6105B. You're good to go. And we've represented...
Judge Fuentes asked you about deterrence. Like, should there be some consideration as to whether there should be serious consequences from this type of conduct, including it's serious enough such that you fall into the Bindurup considerations for being precluded, if I understood Judge Fuentes' question. So your comments didn't sound like they were answering his question about deterrence.
I don't think it can be a deterrent if individuals aren't aware of the fact that it will be triggered by it, is where I was trying to go with my response.
Well, they have Bindurup now and tells them serious offenses. But before Bindurup, your client's offense would trigger 922G1 straight up on application, because it's a... while labeled a misdemeanor, the offense exposed someone to a penalty of greater than 2 years. So under 22G1, by application, your client would have been prohibited It was only with the Binderup decision was there an avenue, putting aside the 1990s mechanism to have your rights restored, was there an avenue for even your client to get access? So there was notice.
I don't know.
922G gave notice.
I don't know that that's necessarily accurate given the Marzarella decision that this court issued in 2010, long before Binderup, where it did acknowledge that Second Amendment as applied challenges could in essence be brought. But,
yeah, but you're saying, if I understood you correctly, you were suggesting a person convicted of an offense under the same statute as your client would not have noticed that they would be losing their firearms. But 922G1 was clear as day and said, yep, correct.
I don't believe individuals are aware of it, unfortunately. And it's been in my experience.
I'm not talking about, I mean, they have no, you're not claiming a due process violation, great.
Not in this case, no.
Okay.
We are not.
That's right.
I mean, there's a separate issue under Padilla and whether, you know, where someone pleads guilty and isn't advised to the potential
different,
loss of constitutional rights.
Totally different.
But in this case, no. This is a Second Amendment as applied challenge. And one of the other issues that I know this court asked us to be prepared to address is the under-inclusive.
Before you do that, let me jump in. Assuming that the panel agrees with you, that your client survives the analysis under Binderup Step 1, and that his Second Amendment, that he can maintains his Second Amendment rights. If we get to Binderup Step 2, what kind of scrutiny?
Obviously, well, Your Honor, I'm acutely aware that Your Honor was part of a concurring opinion that suggested that to the extent we would even get to that point, there really shouldn't be any scrutiny applied, that it should be the fact that you've met the traditional, the factors that they don't apply to you, and therefore that's it. You can't really say that your rights are that worth insisting upon.
The key to that opinion was it was a concurring opinion.
Yeah, I acknowledge that, Your Honor. Obviously, I believe strict scrutiny should apply when we're talking about a constitutional right, when it involves that constitutional right in the home that obviously we know in D.C. v. Heller, the U.S. Supreme Court held that was at the core of the Second Amendment.
How can you say that when in Marzarella we said that intermediate scrutiny applied?
That was, and in fact, in Marzarella, the court actually acknowledged that they weren't sure whether intermediate
but they
or
applied intermediate
they,
scrutiny.
Well, they
and
also
so
said they applied
up,
strict.
And said to a bunch of other precedential cases, so I think that this circuit has already spoken on intermediate scrutiny on under this statute, correct?
Under Binderup, yes, they applied intermediate scrutiny. Again, we did address in our brief what we thought, and we said
but
strict,
was,
but then we also went on to intermediate.
There was a difference of opinion in Binderup as to what the standard does.
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, and I was alluding to this beforehand, this court asked us to address under inclusivity.
And that now we get to that.
If we get to that, and I see I'm out of time, may I respond?
Please answer Judge Fisher's question.
Yes, Your Honor. If we get to that step, then the government has not provided this court or part of the record with any support that these are considered to be within the confines of these preventing armed mayhem or public safety concerns, because if that was the government's position, then it should be denying any individual convicted of a first or second DUI, depending on how you take the government's position, across the United States, regardless of what the penalty that could have been imposed was. And yet we don't see them taking that position. In fact, when the government was asked earlier as to what position it was taking, it specifically stated that it was solely based on the amount of time that the crime could have been punished for. Not even what it was punished for, but could have been punished for.
So you're representing that was your adversary's position right here in front of the three of us?
That was my understanding of her response
right,
to
I'll
that
give her
question.
A chance I didn't hear that position. And I think the difficulty in terms of this, what position should be taken elsewhere in the United States, very few, I don't know anybody else, any other court that is a Binderup type analysis that's you know binding precedent. So I think we can only really talk about how Binderup would be applied in a place that it's binding.
Fair enough.
Right?
And I do know that the court in Marzarella actually addressed under inclusivity. And there the court, again, I know I'm over time, if I may just respond, declared if a regulation fails to cover a substantial amount of conduct implicating the asserted compelling interest, Its under-inclusiveness can be evidence that the interest is not significant enough to justify the regulation. We also have case law from the U.S. Supreme Court in Greater New Orleans Broadband Association. There are a number of cases addressing under-inclusivity. Judge Fuentes, Your Honor, issued a decision along with now Justice Alito in Black Hawk versus Pennsylvania, striking down a permitting application here in Pennsylvania.
Those are all First Amendment cases, so it is a First Amendment doctrine.
But in Bindrup, we even acknowledge that we are going to look to certain First Amendment precedent in relation to determining Second Amendment, and that's consistent with all constitutional rights. We look to how we treat other constitutional rights to determine where there isn't already case law in that regard on how to address it. I know I'm out of time. If anyone has any additional questions, I am more than happy to respond to them. We would just simply ask that this court affirm the district court's decision, and I thank Your Honors.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few quick points on rebuttal. To follow up on something that my friend on the other side said, it's not our position that we look solely to the maximum punishment imposed, but I believe what I said was that the clearest indication of how a state legislature considers a crime to be serious is the maximum punishment imposed. And of course, we've discussed at length that the Pennsylvania General Assembly considers this offense to be so serious that it punishes it far beyond the traditional felony. I wanted to also address the argument that was just made, essentially that the government should be outlawing more conduct. And I think that argument that is very much at odds with what plaintiff has argued all along to the district court and here, that 922 G1 is actually overbroad in that it outlaws nonviolent in addition to violent conduct. And of course, that argument has no force after this court's decision in Bindrup. But I think that is a deeply contradictory argument.
But no, that's an under-inclusive argument, though.
Well, right. And so my point, Your Honor, is that I think in addressing this issue of under-inclusiveness, the argument that plaintiff is putting forth is contradictory to his original position that at step one, and looking at whether or not he's distinguished himself from the class of forfeits their Second Amendment rights. On the one hand, he's saying the 922 G1 is overbroad. It covers too much conduct. It should only cover violent conduct.
But see, doesn't this get back to my question I asked you on your initial argument? Is it fair to Holloway and others like Holloway in Pennsylvania that by the fate of them driving under the influence of alcohol in Pennsylvania, their punishment, as far as the Second Amendment is concerned, is far different than practically all other states, except seven, I believe.
Well,
is that fair to them as a matter of constitutional law across this country?
Well, I'd say, Your Honor, assuming that plaintiff doesn't, assuming that we're at step two now, we're talking about an intermediate analysis. Okay. Assuming that this burdens unprotected conduct, I think the test for intermediate scrutiny is quite clear under Bindrup, under Mazzarella. As the court noted, we look to whether or not there's a reasonable fit between the means and the ends. And of course, we've discussed in our briefing the Wintemute study, among other studies cited in our expert report, that clearly shows, as Bindrup stated, that the plaintiff falls within a category of individuals that is not to be trusted with firearms. And that's sufficient. As Bindrup stated, we can fulfill our burden, assuming we reach step two, by showing reliable statistics that plaintiff falls within a class of individuals that cannot be trusted to responsibly handle firearms. And that's exactly what the Wintemute study shows here. And of course, the district court in no way questioned the reliability or the methodological soundness of that study. Thank you.
Thank you. We thank counsel for well-argued and well-briefed.